From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how Japan is keeping a watchful national security eye on changes in China.
Which China is good for Japan is a difficult question. China under one strong leader or China under the divided leadership? It depends.
We talk with the cast and director of The Brothers Size, which is on stage at the Milwaukee Chamber Theater.
A Milwaukee woman hopes the Roller Derby World Cup won't be the last time you hear of Team Indigenous.
We need to figure out what the next steps are, figure out what our resources are, what our capabilities are in terms of being able to compete again. There definitely will be another team formed at the next World Cup, but that's like 3 to 4 years from now.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of Bubbler Talk. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. When North Korea and South Korea competed in several Winter Olympic sports as a unified team, the news seemed to be a rare de-escalation of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. So, too, with the report this week that North Korea may be open to scaling back its nuclear efforts.
But while that all seems like welcome news, there are many countries that are still wary and watching North Korea closely. Japan, for example, has a long history of animosity with North Korea. Dr. Fumiaki Kubo shared some perspective on the situation with us. He is a professor of American government and history at the University of Tokyo and was in Milwaukee recently. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
What are the overarching concerns Japan has when it comes to its relationship with the United States at this point in time?
Well, you know, we are facing very serious national security threat coming from North Korea, obviously. And in the more long-term perspective, it is also coming from China. So the direction of the national security policy of the United States has always been a serious concern for Japan. So when Mr. Trump got elected in November 2016, I think there was a pretty big concern among the Japanese, and especially within the government of Japan.
Well, and I know President Trump, when he was just a candidate running for president, made reference to the security relationship between Japan and the United States and his concerns that the United States was essentially defending Japan without being paid for it. How does Japan see that relationship, the security relationship?
Well, at that time, my guess is that many Japanese thought that he would not be elected, but no, he was. And so that was a surprise. And after he got elected, Prime Minister Abe of Japan met him first privately in the Trump Tower and officially in February of 2017. And, you know, to our delight, Mr. Trump changed his foreign policy or national security attitude pretty dramatically. He was, in a sense, a very strongly isolationist candidate. He said that NATO was obsolete and Japan should defend itself. But after he became the president, probably persuaded by his subordinates, like Secretary of Defense Mattis, he changed his position in a big way. And he said at the summit meeting between Prime Minister Abe and him in February of 2017 that he would honor the Japan-U.S. security treaty. So, in that front, we do not have a serious concern now. We still have a concern about his trade policy. He left the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. And sometimes he made remarks pretty negative about Japan on trade front. So we still have some concern. And also, sometimes what he says is a little bit inconsistent, even on North Korea. That is also a little bit worrisome to Japan. But overall, I think, you know, the current situation is much better than it looked when he got elected.
The world is watching closely how the United States deals with the threat it sees in North Korea, and I imagine Japan is watching especially closely. What sort of balance is Prime Minister Abe's government looking for between military strength and diplomacy?
Well, that's a good question. The government of Japan or Japanese people would like the United States to be basically tough with North Korea. And many Japanese people does not want the United States to go into a negotiation. It seems to be not based on principle. But at the same time, in some corners of Japan, there is a concern that the United States might make a kind of unilateral military action, which might be a little bit a source of concern for Japan. So, but you know, these days, since Mr. Trump became the president, Prime Minister Abe and Donald Trump has been, in agreement on how to deal with North Korea. And I think they have conducted like 19 times a telephone conversation. So somehow I don't know why, but the personal chemistry between two gentlemen are pretty good. And the direction of policy, as far as North Korea is concerned, has been the same, apply the maximum possible pressure on North Korea so that North Korea would kind of give in and go into negotiation on our terms. So on that front, I think U.S.-Japan relations are pretty good.
How important is sort of unity among Asian nations and the United States when it comes to North Korea versus the United States acting unilaterally?
I think unity is, of course, always an art, and it's very important. But probably the concern that Japan has and the United States has is the direction of the foreign policy of South Korea, the Republic of Korea, because probably from the perspective of the Japanese people or Americans, the direction of the foreign policy of South Korea looks a little bit too naive to, take the offer from North Korea to be on good terms, when there's Olympic Games in February. So, unity is preferable. I think that is not the kind of highest priority agenda for the United States and or for Japan.
How do you see Prime Minister Abe's political future tied to how he manages his relationship with the United States?
Well, I think, it's pretty important. As you might know, Japan is facing a pretty serious existential threat from North Korea. They have nuclear weapons, and also they have missiles. And also many Japanese citizens were abducted by the North Korean government. So, to be tough with North Korea is pretty important for Prime Minister Abe or any government leaders of Japan. And in order for them to do that, the close relation or security relation with the United States has a paramount importance.
There has been a fairly recent and significant development in the leadership in China. Mm-hmm. What does Japan see as the potential either threat or long-term mm-hmm. impact of essentially dealing with a ruler for life, if you will?
Mm. In fact, China might be even more serious threat to the security of Japan in the longer term perspective. For short time, we are now concerned a lot about the direction of the North Korea's national security policy. But in the long term, China is more powerful in many senses. And we have a pretty serious territorial disputes with China. So, our basic concern is more with China. But Which China is good for Japan is a difficult question. China under one strong leader or China under the divided, you know, leadership? It depends, you know. And sometimes the divided Chinese leadership might be more negative on the relationship between Japan and China. And at this moment, it seems that Xi Jinping is looking for ways to make the bilateral relations slightly better. So, you know, I think this is a good sign. But at the same time, the Chinese military ships activity in the disputed island areas have not stopped. So we should not be totally kind of free from concern.
And, of course, China's relationship with the rest of the world is much more complicated than North Korea's. North Korea being so isolated from the world economy, China is very much integrated in the world economy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, the challenge for any country, you know, facing China is to make or strike a balance between the national security concern and dependent economic, you know, relations. I think this is true even with the United States. You know, many American companies made a big, you know, investment in China market, and you know, Japanese companies are the same thing. You know, so you know, to any country, you know, that's striking a balance in these two aspects really important or difficult choice. But you know, in the case of Japan, I think you know, probably. Concern on national security front is now more serious and you know, getting at the top, you know, of the agenda of the national policy.
Of course, I've been asking you about the workings of Japanese government. You have spent a long time studying American government and American politics. As someone who has made this his area of study for so long, what are your impressions of the first year or a little more than a year of the Trump presidency?
Well, I think this presidency is pretty unusual. You know, it is plagued with infighting, and sometimes the president's policies or announcements are inconsistent, and we tend to feel a lack of consistency on many things, especially foreign policy. So I think, you know, this is a government for any, you know, outside government, difficult to deal with. So if you look at the polls in Japan, and there are questions like, what do you think of Mr. Trump? Do you think he's arrogant? Well, and many, like 70% of Japanese people say yes. Or do you think he's unfit for the president? And about overwhelming majority of the Japanese say yes. But if they asked about what do you think of the future of the U.S.-Japan relations, you know, majority of the Japanese say, you know, keep the same relations, you know. So, you know, I think the Japanese people have a very balanced view of the United States or U.S. politics.
Well, and as you spend time in the United States, are there questions that you're finding especially difficult to answer in understanding how American politics is working in 2018? Are there things that you're especially interested in trying to figure out in your time in places like Milwaukee?
No. What I'm kind of concerned is, of course, the division between liberals and the conservatives. This is a pretty well-known division within the U.S. politics. But at the same time, I tend to detect these days, the declining influence of the internationalist, globalist elite in U.S. politics, which is why Mr. Trump got the Republican nomination, and this is why Mr. Trump, you know, got elected, you know. And of course, you know, Japan or many allies are hopeful that the United States would be internationalist, or not to be protectionist, or not to be overly inward-looking. So I think, you know, from this perspective, there's many things that should be worrisome. in U.S. politics these days.
As you say, it's an unusual time, if nothing else.
Yes, very much. And, especially in the long term, for one thing, Mr. Trump is the first kind of isolationist Republican nominee since probably 1945. And he is the first protectionist candidate since 1945 within the Republican Party. And he kind of showed an alternative path to the Republican nomination. You could be a Republican nominee even if you are protectionist and isolationist. And now everyone knows that there is an alternative path. The same thing might happen in 2024, 2028, or 2032. So that is my long-term concern. The United States is becoming a slightly different country, and especially its foreign policy outlook is changing gradually, but in a rather fundamental way.
What made you first want to study American government and American politics?
Well, that's a pretty personal kind of event. But I happened to be sitting in a class on campus at the University of Tokyo. The name of the lecture was U.S. Political and Diplomatic History. And that lecture was very interesting, exciting. So that was why probably I thought I might be studying this subject,
And has it proved to be as interesting and as exciting as you were hoping when you were sitting in that lecture?
Well, looking back, I think, it was exciting, more predictable, more unpredictable, I'm pretty happy to study American politics.
Well, we are happy to have you here, Professor Fumiaki Kubo. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Fumiaki Kubo is a professor of American government and history at the University of Tokyo. He was in Milwaukee recently for an event at Marquette Law School where we had a chance to sit down with him.
Up next, we meet the cast and director of The Brothers' Sighs, a fierce and lyrical play currently on stage at the Broadway Theater Center. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The Milwaukee Chamber Theater production of Terrell Alvin McCraney's play The Brothers' Sighs tells the story of two brothers trying hard to find or cling to their paths in life. Rich with Yoruba imagery and driven by both rhythmic dialogue and a one-man orchestra of percussion instruments, the play is a lyrical and poetic exploration of what it means to be a brother.
I had an opportunity to sit down with Travis Knight and Andrew Mwonge, who play the brothers Ogun and Oshusi, along with the percussionist Yames Finlayson and director Marty Goebel, to find out more about this production.
I want to start with the music, because I know music is such a key part of this play. The rhythm, you when you read the play, the lines are so rhythmic, everything is so, it's almost contrapuntal, when you look at it, almost like a piece of music. So what are you performing? You're kind of a one-man band over here.
Yes, and the production actually starts with music. I come on stage and I kind of set up my altar and all the instruments, and then I call the ancestors and I call the gods and call the characters to the stage. I am playing primarily percussion, and we've created a musical pit that's comprised of found objects, barrels, buckets, cans, and such, and as well as some instruments that I've brought with me. Some of them are also made from repurposed materials.
You've got panpipes there. Could you give us a little taste? Sometimes the bamboo doesn't agree. So now, Travis and Andrew, if you ever hear panpipes again, are you going to be immediately brought back to this play?
Yeah, I'm going to turn around and look and see if Yamas is behind me.
So for you two, you're playing the brothers. when you first read this play and you looked at those parts, what did you think?
I was struck by how beautiful the language is. As you talked about, that script is great. And the way that Terrell writes, it's so lyrical and it's so poetic and it's beautiful. And then in the heart of it all, it's also a story about siblings. And I am the older brother. I have two siblings. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. So that's one thing that I pulled out the most is, like, Ogun is looking out and has always looked out for his younger brother. And I found that to be incredibly relatable. And then because I found that incredibly relatable, I knew how to infuse the rest of this script. And then I was like looking forward to coming to rehearsal the first time and meeting everybody and working with everybody and seeing what they were bringing to the table. And I knew that that was going to be something that audiences could really relate to, no matter where you come from. If you have a sibling or a family member who you love dearly, this is kind of the play for you. And that's what I was drawn to the most by that script.
Yeah, there is that taking care of, and then in your case, Andrew, resenting being taken care of. Mm-hmm.
I am the youngest in my family. I don't have a brother, but I have two older sisters, so I related to my character in that way. I knew it was going to be interesting just because of the way the play is structured. It wasn't like anything I've ever done before. Like, we were speaking stage directions, there's music. It was just a brand new thing to me.
Yeah, there was a lot of, like, reading the script, because one of the things that people keep asking who have seen the show, it's like, so I want to read this. Like, is it in the stage? It's like, no, that play comes bare bones. It comes with just the words. There's no stage directions in it. There's nothing to kind of tell you what these scenes are supposed to look like. So sometimes it's just a bunch of what looks like random, like, huzz and this road is rough and things like that, that you're like, how are we going to make this a story? So I was very curious how we were going to do that, but I knew that Marty had a bunch of things up her sleeve.
I did.
Well, and that is a perfect segue to you. What drew you to the play?
I was given the brother-sister plays, the complete trilogy, probably 5 years ago with, you know, an eye towards actually performing in the Red and Brown Water as Oya. And then intended to do, with my former company Uprooted, Travis and I's former company Uprooted, intended to do an entire season just focusing on the trilogy. And it was just too expensive to do. So when the opportunity came around again to direct in the Red and Brown Water with the collaboration with Marquette and Uprooted, I jumped on it. And that was fantastic. So I got to sink my teeth into it. And then we did that same season do a reading of The Brother's Sighs, which Michael Wright came to see and asked if I would be interested in directing it under Chambers' umbrella. And I said, absolutely. At this point, we knew that Uprooted was going to be closing its doors at the end of that particular season. I have a really great imagination, and I knew that I could do a lot with this if I had a room of collaborators. So, you know, the character of the Agungun is not included in this play, but I couldn't see how the ancestors wouldn't be called without a musician. I am fond of drumming and live music on stage, and so that is something that all of us in the room, of course, with Yames doing the work of it, I knew that music had to be a part of it. And then my brother-in-law came in and helped with the step coordination and the choreography. I'm not a dancer, but I know what beautiful movement looks like. So it really was just a whole bunch of people with great ideas who loved a fantastic script.
Yeah, talk about this playwright. I mean, he is so powerful. It's so evocative. And the language is so raw and wonderful. And yet elevated at the same time. It's like somehow he balances all of that.
Well, again, I've had the plays for some time, and I was really struck with the notion that you could let people know what they were looking at based on you speaking to them, what you were feeling or what you were doing. And I wonder how much confusion in life would be avoided if we could just know what we were looking at. You know, we misinterpret human physical and facial cues so many times. So that was a fantastic instrument that he has figured out how to do. And I don't believe that anyone has done that before. It's also, his writing is evidence of his confidence in himself as a black man in America and understanding where he came from. So that I think will cover all of his works, including the movie Moonlight. which is somebody just struggling to be solid in self, which Terrell obviously had to go through at some point in time, as we all do, but he sure landed in a solid spot.
Had you two known, or all three of you, known his work before?
I read the plays years ago. I own the trilogy. It's part of, like, my, it's on my bookshelf. And I read it years and years ago, and I loved it, and I thought it was beautiful again, but it was that whole idea of, like, how is this even, how do you stage this? What does it look like? Because I'd never seen it, and I hadn't been in Chicago, because it was at Steppenwolf years ago, and that was before my time in Chicago, so I didn't get a chance to see it. But I remember hearing things about it, and so I've always been struck by it. I've always thought it was beautiful. And then, yeah, I saw Moonlight last year and was like, wow, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what this could be.
Okay. There he is, yeah. And Andrew, for you?
I had seen Moonlight, but it's really, the language is way different.
Like, oh,
it's
yeah.
just different structurally than this play. I had seen In the Red and Brown Water that Marty directed a couple of years ago. So when she asked me to be a part of this, I was like, okay.
Yeah. And as we said, the music is so much part. It's almost like it's the fourth character in this play, the way it's being described. Because again, the structure of it is so musical and so rhythmic.
It is, and I'd agree. And sometimes I'm actually mirroring or echoing some of the language on the drums in some of the interludes that I play, and. This is my first exposure to his writing and his work. I did see Moonlight, but I didn't get into it on this level. And I've been struck, even as we go through the play, how the language, there's a circularity and a rhythm to it. So things that are spoken early on, like, come back at different points in the plays, and there are things that I'm still learning. I'm there every night, participating in the telling of this story, but there's new information that's coming up all the time, and some of it just really gives me goosebumps and pulls tears when I realize that he has, you know, forespoken certain things that then come back, and the language, it's really incredible. And it's kind of, it'll catch people off guard when they first are getting into it, when they first, you know, are listening to people speak their stage directions and all, but it's really amazing.
Now, was this something you composed with the cast, or did you come in with ideas or musical motifs already?
I came as a blank slate and just and responded. And also, you know, I'm a very intuitive musician anyway, so I listen to the energy in the room and to what's going on. And sometimes instruments will even give you nudges in certain directions. But sometimes I would play something and they're like, what did you do? It's like, that's not here. Let's listen to the tape. Let's, like, because what you did then, let's set that, you know. So it was a process.
So you've created a score.
True. Yeah, I mean, it does happen in the room. Yames and I worked together on The Ballad of Emmett Till. So he knew how I worked, which is, I would say something, I need a scary swamp feel. And then he would take those words and interpret them into sound. But it does need to be said that the composition of this music happened in the room, mm-hmm. in the same way that the actors are composing and putting their characters together, mm-hmm. which again is a testament to Terrell's script. I love that it's so lean, and he gives you no direction. And to me, that is deep trust in one's writing ability, mm-hmm. to say, take it and dream with it.
Yeah. Do something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get to be part of it.
Yes.
You get to be part of that creation. It's like it's slightly unfinished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's really, I don't know if you've read it, there's nothing. mm-hmm. There's nothing in there. This has been an incredibly collaborative process. I can't say it any clearer than that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. We took some thoughts and ideas in a spiritual tradition, and we just got together in a room with no egos. Very rarely does that happen in this profession. And unparalleled trust in what each of us could and would do.
Mm-hmm. Which I think, it, along with his writing, he writes in such a lean and theatrical style that some of this text is like, it's so heightened. It's like on the level with verse and classical text and things like that. So then to have to rise to the occasion to take this theatrical language and just infuse it with honesty and authenticity was a challenge, but also incredibly rewarding, because we're constantly doing that. And every performance, we're still finding moments to, like, live in that truth and make it real and act as humans act, as Marty told us to do throughout the rehearsal
process. Be humans.
Be humans. Remember what that's like.
But also gods at the same time.
At the same time. Yes, because, oh, there's very much that part of it, too.
Well, the characters are all named after deities or orisha in the Yoruba spiritual tradition. So they are gods, and each of them, they're archetypes, and each of them have different energies, and that's also influenced, you know, some of the music as well.
Well, and I was thinking as I was reading it, because of that sort of human and deity all at the same time, it was very Greek.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
You can tell he's done his reading,
mm-hmm.
and
oh,
yes. he's watched a lot of Greek plays.
It makes me want to tackle some of,
the
you know,
Oristia
oh my
something.
Goodness,
yeah.
Aeschylus, yeah. all of these. I would love to just jump in there now. I'm like, oh, I got this.
Now I know how to do that.
Now, I mean, I guess I already did,
yeah.
you know?
Do you think we're in a point in our cultural history where the black voices and the black experience is getting a new kind of respect and a new kind of listening? It feels like it with Peele winning, you know, the Oscar for screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like there's been a shift. And I don't know if that's me looking at it from the outside in, you know, as a white person looking at it going, oh, I think some things are changing. I mean, do you feel like they are?
I do. I think shift is definitely happening. I've had people come up to me after the show and say, oh, I've never seen anything like that before. I want to see more. So I think that the interest is definitely there and the voices are getting louder. It's like in this play, so you get to see black people not how you typically see them. You get to see the vulnerability. And I feel like when you usually see black people, it's like you see the masculinity. Like that's the focus. So it's nice to be portrayed in a slightly different light, show people a different side of people.
It's stereotypes. You all get into whatever that stereotype of the moment is, and it feels like here, at least in this particular play, you're getting to be fully human.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I mean, it's. Yeah. I think we are at an age now that we've all known all along, if people would have just listened sooner, you know what I mean? It would have started sooner. But like, yeah, now we are at a point now where it is everywhere. We have this play that people aren't used to seeing. You've got Black Panther out there right now that it grossed. So like all these old tropes and notions that like, oh, well, black-led films and television shows can't make money and people aren't interested in that kind
it's
of
like
thing.
Women it's, can't yeah, do it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It is now being blown wide open and people are forced to listen because it's out there and the voices are louder now than they've ever been.
Well, and as we know, the second part of what you do is business, you know, for mm-hmm. show business. And the fact that, like, Black Panther is hugely popular and hugely profitable is going to make a huge difference, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's that. Unfortunately, we have that economic piece that has to come in.
Mm-hmm.
But once it does, it's people go, oh, why didn't we see this before?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I still think there's a lot of growth to happen. You know, this is my constant soapbox. I love that Milwaukee is embracing this play so much and seeing the quality of a lot of things, the design elements, the actors, the quality of the audience and their willingness to respond or to be still as they watch the plays. I would love to see more. There's still more. There's more to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A lot more.
I think the war's never won.
No.
You just have to keep fighting.
Oh, yeah.
And you win little things here and there, but there's always you're always going to have to fight another day.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's never time or room to be complacent. Like, it's just mm-hmm. something that we have to continually fight for and do. So, yeah.
Right.
That's absolutely right.
Well, I want to thank all of you for, I know you have a performance coming up and you need to go prepare, but thanks so much for sitting and talking with me.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Bonnie. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Marty Goebel directed The Brothers' Size, Travis Knight and Andrew Mwangi star as the brothers, and Yames Finlayson is the percussionist. The show is currently playing in the Studio Theater in the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward, and it runs through March 18th. We'll take another break now, and then a Milwaukee woman hopes the Roller Derby World Cup won't be the last time you hear of Team Indigenous. That story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North.
A few weeks ago, we spoke with Jennifer Bennett, a Milwaukee woman who was headed to England to compete for Team Indigenous in the Flat Track Roller Derby World Cup. The team consisted of women from Indigenous communities in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and South America. Bennett, who skates for Milwaukee's Brew City Bruisers, had competed for Canada in a previous World Cup.
The team, which had been assembled remotely by its organizers, finished in 27th place out of 38 teams and was the subject of a multimedia feature in the New York Times this week. So we invited Jennifer Bennett back to the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you skated for Team Indigenous in the 2018 World Cup in England, right?
Yes.
And we talked with you before you went out there. And one of the things that struck me was how the team came together essentially over Skype and a lot of long distance communication. What was the actual process of gelling as a team that was physically all in the same place at the same time like?
Well, we had two practices before the tournament started, thankfully, and we used that time to make some adjustments. Some of us utilized different defensive strategies and also different like offensive strategies to a certain extent. And so I think we spent probably most of that time ironing out those kinks and then also figuring out like what our weaknesses were and how to develop our lineups that would kind of adjust around them. And then we started, and I feel like we were probably still making adjustments as the tournament went on, as we were kind of getting to know everybody's skating style and then also trying to balance having fun with, you know, being competitive and, you know, making sure that everybody was enjoying themselves and that sort of thing.
And we talked about this in our pre-interview, I guess, the pressure on coming together for such a short period of time with, you know, such a kind of lofty goal.
Yes, it was a lot of pressure. It was very intense. And we skated against some competitors that come from really tiny countries. We skated against Denmark and the Netherlands and Iceland. And all three of those places are very tiny, and so a lot of those team members skate with each other all the time. So we were definitely at a disadvantage with that. And then I'm not sure how many people recognize the irony in that our first team opponent was against Team Italy.
I'm not sure I recognize the irony.
That's where Christopher Columbus is.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense, sure.
Yes, what flag he flew under. And we were the first game. We opened up the tournament, and that was really nerve-wracking because we wanted to do well. We wanted to perform. We wanted to win. And we were also still in the process of making adjustments. So it was very intimidating to have all those eyes on you. Granted, we had a lot of people in the team who were rooting for us – or, sorry, in the crowd that were rooting for us. We were definitely feeling it. And I think we did pretty well. We ended up with, like, it was like 91-67 to Team Italy in our first game, I want to say. And throughout this process, I was staying in an Airbnb with 10 other of my teammates, which helped us get to know each other a lot better and, you know, form camaraderie on the track and everything.
Right. You can know each other from corresponding by email or over Skype, but there's nothing like actually being in the same place at the same time.
Yeah. And having to navigate bathrooms and cooking food together and, you know, sleep schedules and all that stuff.
What was the sort of reception you got from the other teams and the roller derby community at large that was there for the World Cup?
It's hard to say because it's a very different experience skating in a tournament environment and like literally competing in a tournament environment and then being someone who's watching. So we were a little distance from it and it was hard to kind of gauge the audience, I guess you could say, like gauge what people thought of us. I felt like we were received extremely well by at least Iceland, Denmark, and the Netherlands. They were really wonderful teams to skate against, and that makes a big difference. They were very cordial and had very good, you know, track manners and everything. Team Italy was kind of a blur because it was so early in the morning.
It was the first one.
And it was the first game, and it was like all the jitters were out. And I feel like we heard a lot of compliments sort of after the fact. It was like when everything was said and done, like then the posts and the accolades and the acknowledgments were kind of filtering in through social media that way.
It's interesting, just having watched a lot of the Winter Olympics, you see some of the athletes from countries that aren't normally represented at the Winter Olympics, and the best compliment they talk about getting is this idea that they belong to, you know, they belong there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may not have beaten the Swiss or the, you know, or the Norwegians, but they were on a playing field and they belonged to be on the playing field. And it sounds like a similar situation for you.
Yeah, I'm sure that a lot of those teams had no idea what to expect. There were a few of the team members that came from some extremely high-ranking teams that are extremely competitive teams. And then there were some of us that came from little tiny places in British Columbia and New Zealand and had never heard of our teams before or our leagues. And I'm sure that they did not know what to expect. And I think that we really came together on the track as a team, and we really played like a team. And our individual skill sets, I think, were allowed to shine. And I ended up staying in Amsterdam for a few days after the tournament. And on my flight to Amsterdam from Manchester, a good chunk of Team Netherlands was on the plane with me. And in fact, there was one of the jammers. She was sitting behind me. And the whole ride, she was talking to her seat neighbor about the game and about the tournament and what she was doing. And then I turned around and I told her, I said, hey, you were a really great jammer. You were really fun to skate against. And she looked at me like really confused. And I was like, I was on Team Indigenous. You remember your last game or your second to last game? And then she went on and on and on about how we were an extremely strong team and that we were really, really difficult and made her life, or our defensive walls made her life very difficult. And so that was a really nice compliment to actually get from a competitor. Mm. I think it was our first appearance, and so therefore we kind of established ourselves as belonging there with this first appearance.
Well, and you say it was your first appearance. For this to be a successful enterprise, it sounds like there need to be more appearances.
Yes, for sure. And I think we're going to have a decompression meeting in the next couple of weeks to talk about this, because we've also had a couple people who came up to us and asked us if we would travel to skate against some team in France and Germany. And I can say that we don't necessarily probably have the financial resources for that, you know, to happen in May. But it's nice to know that we've put our name out there and that we have people who are interested in competing against us. I think that's what we just need to do. We need to figure out what the next steps are, figure out what our resources are, what our capabilities are in terms of being able to compete again. There definitely will be another team formed at the next World Cup, but that's like 3 to 4 mm-hmm. years from now.
Well, and you also were followed around by a team from the New York Times that mm-hmm. documented the experience. How did that happen, and what was the impact of that? I mean, they did a multimedia feature on you that just went live in the last couple of days.
It was really incredible. They were two freelance journalists based out of Johannesburg and Nairobi.
And so just around the corner from Manchester.
Yes, they flew to come do this feature on us. So I think at first, I know that Mick Swagger, the kind of the main organizer, she was a little skeptical. She wanted to make sure that our message was clear and that we established our boundaries in terms of, you know, the starting point of our message and, you know, sort of what we're doing here and our mission statement, and that there were no hidden agendas or anything like that. And so she established that right away. And we got to know the journalists, too, because we're like, well, you know, we're a pretty insular little 19 or 17 person group. Like, you're about to be part of us since you're following us around everywhere. So I quizzed them. We had a team dinner on a Wednesday night, and I quizzed them about their extremely glamorous lives. It sounded like they led some pretty amazing lives, and I thought they deserved a feature themselves. But it was really good. I asked the main writer how she found us. So she's in Johannesburg, and she ended up going to a derby bout, one of the Johannesburg local league, back in the fall sometime. And on their bout brochure, there was a plug for Team South Africa. And she thought that was like really interesting, and like read about this World Cup. And then she went and checked them out online. And she also noticed that they were, I think they're all white. So they're all white South Africans. And she thought that was kind of peculiar, given that South Africa is a predominantly African nation. And so she poked around and was doing some internet research, I guess you could say, about all the different teams, and then she came across ours. And it really piqued her interest, and then she contacted the lead organizer to see if she could organize this multi-day affair. So it was good, though. They were really kind, and I felt like they really, really understood where we were coming from and what we were trying to do and what we were trying to accomplish there. And I think she had a lot of really great interviews with, like, you know, the vast majority of us. And so I feel like, you know, hearing it in 17 different voices really drove it home for her. And I think that's also why she was able to write such a beautiful article. Yeah, it was great.
Is there a certain changing of the face of roller derby that you think you've at least been able to start sparking?
Well, to be honest, I don't think that we necessarily started it. I actually think that it started with Team West Indies at the 2014 Roller Derby World Cup. I remember I was on a pregnancy leave at the time, and I remember coming to the World Cup that was in Dallas, Texas. I used to live down the road in Houston, and I remember just being struck by their existence, and I was like, wow, that's really cool. Like, it took me a minute to get it, and then I was like, yeah, no, that's where they're from. You know, granted, like, Tobago is, like, a little too small of a country to have, like, their own team, and I get that there is, like, a distinct West Indies culture for, like, the Black diaspora. So I kind of figured they started it, and then I think it, you know, we had been talking about it, but I feel like they really started the first dialogue. And I know that we're not the only ones either, because there was a Team Korea present and Team Japan. Team Japan was a mix of folks from Tokyo and I think Okinawa and the U.S. as there aren't any teams in Korea as far as I know. So most of the Team Korea were first generation or second generation immigrants. But I feel like all of our presence really had an impact on that, as well as Team Mexico. Team Mexico was there and they did outstanding. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that Team Mexico doesn't belong to the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, which is like the equivalent of like the NHL or the
it's like the governing body.
Yeah, the governing body. And none of the Mexican teams belong to the governing body. I'm trying to figure out why. I think it has something to do with insurance. So they have their own. So they skate underneath like whatever the Mexican Roller Derby Association. And they pretty much only skate against each other. And to see how far their athleticism has come in the last just 4 years, they were barely like a speck at the last World Cup. And this year they came in like in the top 10, I want to say, or if not the top 10, it was like the top 12. And they really looked amazing. So.
Well, Jennifer Bennett, congratulations. And we'll look forward to hearing what's next.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Jennifer Bennett competed as a member of Team Indigenous in the recent Flat Track Roller Derby World Cup in Manchester, England. She's also a member of Milwaukee's Brew City Bruisers. You can find a link to the New York Times feature on Team Indigenous at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk asks why UW-Milwaukee does not have a football team. Or does it? Stick around to find out on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge. I'm Rachel Morello. And like many of you, I am a total cheesehead.
Go, Pack, go!
Packer Pride is arguably one of the strongest fandoms in professional football. As far as college football goes, Wisconsin is synonymous with the Badgers. But they're in Madison. Which brings us to this week's Bubbler Talk question. Why isn't there a big college football team in Milwaukee?
The UWM had a football team for a long time. It actually started in 1899 and ran through the mid-1970s.
That's Ben Barbera, curator at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. He revisited the city's college football scene for his latest exhibit on Milwaukee sports history. Turns out both UWM and Marquette used to have varsity football teams, and winning ones at that.
The UWM played at various different levels, Division II, NAIA. In the 40s and 50s, they were pretty successful, won a lot of conference championships. Marquette also had a very successful football program. They started playing in 1892, and in the 1920s, they were one of the best teams in the country.
Both schools sent players into the pros, guys like John Big Train Sisk and Laverne Dilweg, who went on to play for the Packers and, sadly, the Bears. But despite their success, both programs only lasted through the late 60s and early 70s. School leaders voted to disband the teams. Why? Barbera attributes it to a combination of university funding issues and low attendance.
Milwaukee wasn't a big college football town in this period, so the teams weren't drawing particularly well, and athletic department budgets weren't what they are today. The most expensive sport by far in any athletic program is football because of the equipment, the number of players, number of coaches. And so for both of these schools, when they were looking at their budgets, they knew that the biggest, easiest savings was going to be to cut the football program.
That allowed UWM to save other sports, like basketball, soccer, baseball, and volleyball. But football hasn't been entirely wiped out on campus. UWM has had a growing club football program since 2003. Here's team president Dean Sopcich, a junior.
Well, I think the general consensus is that, oh, we don't have a team, so then that's kind of the end of it, but people wouldn't know to go and look further for a club team that we have on campus.
Just like an NCAA team, Panther club football travels to play other schools. They compete within a conference, facing off against club teams at schools as wide-ranging as Southern Illinois, Edwardsville, and Ohio State. Their season ends in playoffs, and if they win, a national championship. But unlike a varsity program, this club squad requires less of a time commitment. Two practices per week and about eight games per season. And students run the show, managing budgets, coordinating schedules, fundraising. Some club teams even rely on the players themselves to act as their own coaches. Panther football runs with the help of six volunteer coaches, including head coach Sean McKenzie. He played for the club team back when he was a student at UWM.
I think a lot of people associate club sports in general at kind of a lower level, like intramural sports. People just don't really think we're an actual football team. When we are, we put on pads, we hit people, you know, we play pretty high-level football.
Lack of spotlight is an obvious drawback to playing for a club team. Junior Dean Sopcich says at times, it can seem like the UWM community lacks school spirit because there isn't quote-unquote real football here. But he thinks his team can build morale back up.
I don't expect us to get to Madison level, but if we can get people to our games, we can supply that demand that people are asking for.
The team finished with a 3-2 record last year, something they'll work to improve next fall, hopefully with more fans in tow.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
And Bubbler Talk finishes Friday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski. Claudia Delgadillo is our production intern.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Michelle Maternowski is WUWM's managing editor. And Willie Porter wrote our theme music. We have two goodbyes today. Today is Rachel Morello's last day on the education beat for WUWM. She is staying in education, though, taking a new position at the Prairie School in Racine.
And goodbye to Mayan Silver, who joined Lake Effect as a production volunteer and worked her way through the ranks. She moves all the way to the northeast corner of the building, where she'll soon begin work as a full-time member of the WUWM News Department. Major congratulations to both of them on the next exciting chapters in their lives.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us for our next chapter, Lake Effect Weekend, that is, 3 o'clock Saturday and Sunday right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay with us because fresh air is next.